Are you a true crime fan looking to add a new show to your list of favorites? Are you interested in learning about cases that you've probably never even heard about? Hi, I'm Kayla, one of your hosts here at Black True Crime, where my sister and I research and discuss murders committed by Black offenders. From their upbringing to their complete moral demise, we discuss it all. Anyone and everyone is welcome to enjoy the show, but it may not be enjoyed by anyone and everyone, so listener discretion is advised. Black True Crime releases new episodes every week and is available wherever you get your podcasts. So start listening today. We can't wait for you to join us.
The Oracle Network. Hello and welcome to Reverie True Crime. I'm your host, Paige. Please stay tuned after the episode for your Patreon shoutouts. Today's story is a long one, so let's jump right into it. The tragedy that happened in Greene County, located in eastern Tennessee, on April 6, 1997, still haunts the community and many others to this very day. However, this story begins in Pikeville, Kentucky, where six teenagers who were troubled, failing in school, and with five of the six teenagers attending Betsy Lane High School, ran in the same circles and either knew of each other or were friends with one person who knew another, and that is how they all connected. Almost every one of these kids were having issues with alcohol and drug abuse. The six teenagers were 18-year-old Natasha Cornett, 18-year-old Crystal Sturgill, 14-year-old Jason Bryant, 19-year-old Edward, who also goes by his middle name Dean Mullins, 17-year-old Karen Howell, and the oldest of the six, 20-year-old Joseph Risner. They got together and decided to ditch their unhappy lives in Pikeville, Kentucky, and go on a journey to New Orleans, Louisiana. According to court records, Madonna Wallen married Don Adkins in 1958. The marriage produced one daughter, Valina Adkins. The couple divorced in 1966, and 4 years later, Madonna married Ed Wallen. Not long after their marriage, Natasha was born out of an affair by her mother. At age five, Natasha learned that Roger Burgess, a Pikeville, Kentucky police officer, was her natural father. Madonna and Ed divorced in 1982, at which time Valina Adkins, who was a victim of possible sexual abuse by her stepfather, moved out of state. Although Madonna did not remarry during Natasha's childhood, she had a number of relationships with other men. One of her boyfriends, Norman Bryant, made an attempt to be a father figure to Natasha. However, when Natasha was seven, Norman split from Madonna after he knew that she was constantly cheating on him, on top of her violent outbursts. In 1985, Madonna was successfully treated for breast cancer. During that time, Natasha developed a close relationship with her maternal grandmother, Dovey Stratton. Dovey provided some stability in Natasha's life. Her grandmother did have a gallbladder attack the same year and, quote, died on the table, but was, quote, brought back to life. After Dovey was revived, she claimed that she could see things and could speak with dead people. Natasha was captivated with her grandmother's conversations of the paranormal, an experience which contributed to Natasha's interest in the occult. Dovey died in 1987. That same year that she lost her grandmother, Natasha's mother had a nervous breakdown and back surgery. After Madonna had an affair with a married attorney, she filed a suit for sexual harassment, but the case was dismissed. During this time, she was also diagnosed as manic depressive, and she was prescribed medication and began psychiatric counseling. Madonna's behavior was even more erratic during this time. On occasion, she was abusive toward Natasha, who began experiencing serious bouts with bulimia and depression. In the sixth grade, Natasha lost 30 pounds and she was hospitalized for her eating disorder. When Natasha's biological father, Roger's wife, died, he tried to have a fatherly connection with her and began to really accept her as his daughter. The relationship was described as on again, off again. Natasha grew up poor and struggled, but she was said to be a sweet child and great in school until she hit the sixth grade. At that time, she began to self-harm, and she only started doing it more often as she got older. Until the sixth or seventh grade, Natasha was described as being a child who dressed conservatively, but she started wearing only black clothes, painted her nails black, and wore dark lip and eye makeup. Around the age of 14, Natasha started drinking and drugging. She was frequently using heroin, ecstasy, acid, and cocaine. When Natasha was 14, she stole a box of Chex, and eventually she was taken into custody for forgery of said Chex. The juvenile court sentenced her to 1 year of probation, and at the same age, she was in the middle of self-mutilation when her mother caught her. Natasha assaulted her mother, allegedly saying that she was going to murder her. Natasha was arrested for the assault, but her mother decided to drop the charges. Natasha was hospitalized for 11 days, and she received psychiatric care. After the 11 days, she was still going to outpatient therapy and diagnosed as being manic depressive and having bipolar disorder. She was prescribed Prozac and lithium. She kept going to outpatient treatment for 4 months. When Natasha was 15, she went to a treatment program that was to assist children through school, and it helped them deal with family problems. Natasha's grades began to drop, and before she could finish ninth grade, she dropped out, saying school was not doing her any good. Being a babysitter was the only work she had ever done. Natasha had a boyfriend named Steve Cornett. They had been together for over a year, and he was involved with her when she wrote the bad checks. Steve and Natasha got married on her 17th birthday. Natasha said their marriage was in no way satanic. They just dressed in gothic clothes and the maids of honor were chained together. This marriage only lasted 10 months before it all fell apart. Natasha was dealing with depression after the divorce, and she moved to New Orleans where she was panhandling with a girl that she was friends with. They were homeless, and they were living wherever they could find a place on the streets to lay their heads down. Natasha said she was raped while she was in New Orleans, and her mother, Madonna, let Natasha come back home. Their relationship was still terrible, but Madonna allowed her daughter's friends to come over for sometimes days at a time with no supervision at all. So now let's talk about Edward Dean Mullins. At 19 years old in 1996, he dropped out of high school in the middle of his senior year, but still worked on his GED. Dean never committed a crime, and in 1993-94, he worked at a grocery store. Dean and Natasha met, and that's when Dean's family said he started to change for the worse and became troublesome. He and Natasha even had plans to get hitched. Joseph Risner was adopted by his stepfather and never met his real father, Christopher Johns, who his mother Mary was married to. The two got divorced before Joseph was born. When he was two, his mom married Ray Risner, and though he was never adopted by Ray, Joseph chose to go by his last name. Originally, Joseph and his family resided in Columbia, Kentucky, where he loved playing Little League baseball from kindergarten to third grade, and he loved dogs. In the summer of 1986, when he started fourth grade, the family had moved to Georgia for a short stint. His stepfather, Ray, started up a construction business, and he would even pay Joseph to do odd jobs around the sites. Joseph was a great student. He was ambitious and motivated. He was also a hard worker, all until his mother and stepfather parted ways. Ray was smoking pot, using cocaine, and drinking on a regular basis. Mary was also smoking pot and using cocaine. In 1988, Ray and one of Mary's closest friends, or who she thought was a close friend, hooked up, and that caused them to split. That is when, emotionally, Joseph began to spiral. He and his mother traveled back to Kentucky to live with Mary's sister, Josephine. In 1991, Ray and Mary finally got a divorce, after they had tried to reconcile a few times, but they just couldn't make it work. Joseph wouldn't hear from Ray again until after April of 1997. Joseph began smoking pot, drinking, and using LSD when he was around 10 or 11. He even claimed that he was sleeping with two of his babysitters. I'm not sure of their ages, but he said this happened when he was only 12. In 7th grade, he began to do worse in school, failing 7th and 8th grade. However, by 10th grade, he started doing a lot better and graduated from Betsy Lane High School. Joseph felt rejected by his stepfather Ray, and when his mother remarried a man named Larry Castle in 1993, he started calling Larry Papa, and they had a great relationship. The family even had good times smoking pot together. In the summer of 1994, while Joseph was still in high school at Betsy Lane, is where he met the other five teenagers, and he started a relationship with Natasha Cornett. Joseph's mother could not stand Natasha and said that she had a terrible attitude and that she was disrespectful. They dated for a short time, but after they broke up, they stayed friends. In early 1995, Joseph and Karen Howell, who I will talk about shortly, started dating, and she was 15 at the time and Joseph was 18. On April 25th, 1995, Joseph's stepfather Larry was involved in a car accident, which resulted in the death of the driver of the other car and serious injury to a passenger. Larry pled guilty to charges of reckless homicide and second-degree assault. In June of 1995, Joseph decided to join the Army. He wasn't there for even a year before he was discharged because he took a marijuana test that came back positive. When he tried to get through his senior year, he dropped out. He blamed this on family issues surrounding his stepfather's convictions. On May 29, 1996, Joseph did pass his GED test. He had moved in with a friend, but he went back home to his family in June of 1996. The following month, Larry was sentenced to 5 years in prison. This devastated Joseph and his mother. They visited Larry at the prison nearly every day. In September of 1996, Joseph was accepted and attended Mayo Regional Technology Center. In January of 1997, Joseph was starting his third term at the Technology Center, and in March, he and Karen Howell got back together. Karen was living with Natasha, who was dating Dean at the time. Joseph was madly in love with Karen. Crystal Sturgill was an 18-year-old senior at Betsy Lane High School in 1997. Her mother was Teen Blackburn, but she would never say what Crystal's father's name was. It's not even on Crystal's birth certificate. Crystal had a stepfather, Gene Blackburn, who was not a good man at all, as we will get into shortly. Gene and Teen had two children together, Nicole, age 15 at the time, and Estelle, 14. Despite what Crystal was going through, she was a great student and above average even. Not only was she going to high school, but she was also going to Floyd County Technical School in Drift, Kentucky. When her grades started to go downhill, she said it was due to substance abuse. When it came to her ACT score, she made a 28 and even applied to various colleges. She was a smart girl, working at the Betsy Lane Elementary School daycare, making really high marks, and she was doing that as a part of a co-op program. They said Crystal was great with children and an excellent caregiver. She had even planned to attend Murray State after graduating from high school, and she hoped to major in child psychology. Crystal showed a lot of promise. The only times that she was ever really in trouble was when she was suspended twice from school. One time it was for smoking in the locker room, and the other time was for fighting on a school bus, but she was defending her younger brother. Like I mentioned, her stepfather was not a good man. He was rotten to the core. Not only was Crystal neglected emotionally by both of her parents, but in December of 1996, she confessed that her stepfather had been sexually abusing her all of the time since she was 4 until she started dating a boy named Patrick at the age of 13. Patrick also said that Jean confided in him what he had been doing to Crystal. Crystal's mother never knew what was going on with her. She wasn't present in Crystal's life, and she didn't seem to care. When these allegations were made against Gene, he admitted to having abused Crystal and pled guilty to the charges brought against him. The accusations created a conflict within her family. Her mother refused to believe that Gene had sexually abused Crystal, even after he said himself that he did. Other family members also refused to believe it, causing further division within the family. After that, Crystal wanted to get out of that terrible home and situation. In late December of 1996, or right around the beginning of January 1997, she started living with her aunt, who lived in Prestonburg. There, she went to Prestonburg High School in 1997. Crystal's mother did not contact her or provide her with support. At Christmas, Crystal was not even allowed to see or speak to her younger brother and sister, and they were not allowed to keep any gifts from her. It wasn't long before Crystal's aunt made her move out, since her son was moving back home from Arizona. Crystal ended up living at least in 13 different places before the absolutely horrifying event that would soon occur in April of 1997. The way Crystal was involved in the mix of these other kids was that she was close friends with Dean, and since he was with Natasha, she let Crystal live with her. Well, Crystal didn't really approve of Dean being with Natasha, and didn't really even like her, but Crystal didn't have anywhere else to go at this point. It's really a shame that she was tied up with this crew because she had never committed a crime or acted out in a violent way. It wasn't in her nature. Next to last of the six was Jason Bryant, the youngest, only 14 years old at the time. Jason was mentally and emotionally impaired, with an IQ of 85, and had the state of mind emotionally and socially of an 11-year-old. It's reported that when Jason was only 3, he started drinking and even using drugs, and he never stopped. While in the 8th grade, he was considered a legal minor, and around a month before the tragedy would happen, he met Natasha in March of 1997. She happened to pass by him and offer him a lift when he was on a street corner, and they proceeded to go to her house, where she gave him vodka and bourbon. Natasha was 18 at the time. She and Jason kissed that evening, and he spent the night with Natasha, who claims that she didn't know he was 14 until the next morning. Jason said that he didn't see Natasha anymore after that until April of 1997, and that's when he met Joseph, Crystal, and Dean. Jason had already met Karen in 1996. Now, Karen Howell, originally from Ohio, she and her family picked up their lives and settled down in Kentucky when Karen was a toddler. Her childhood was rough, to say the least. Karen's parents divorced when she was 9 years old, but before they split, she witnessed some extremely violent bouts that they had. Karen had an IQ of 78, which made her borderline mentally disabled. To add to her awful childhood, at the age of 5, she began getting sexually abused by her uncle on her father's side, and her cousin as well, until she was 10 years old. This made her terrified to ever be in a romantic relationship. When she was 13, she began to self-harm. Karen lived with her mother, but it wasn't all rainbows and butterflies. The relationship that she had with her was unhealthy, and they constantly fought. Karen didn't like to abide by any rules, and she always rebelled. She wasn't doing well in school, she was abusing drugs, running away often, and she was fascinated by witchcraft. Karen would use a Ouija board and automatic writing, which is basically letting your hand unconsciously write whatever words happen to come out. When her mother discovered what her daughter was dabbling in, she brought in ministers to cast the demons out of Karen, who said she made love potions to get 2 boys to go out with her. She also said that she could hear voices. Karen went to live with her father for a short time, which was after her first semester of high school. He was pretty distant and never paid attention or communicated with Karen at all. She quit going to school but worked on getting her GED. Karen was a very young teenager when she started using LSD mainly, but also marijuana, hash, shake, PCP, and cocaine. LSD was her drug of choice. She said she had 2 awful trips. Once it was so bad that she attempted to chew her friend's arm off. And during the other trip, she sat on the bathroom floor, just staring into space for hours. Other than the trip where she was chewing on her friend's arm, she wasn't normally violent and had never committed a crime. Like most of the 6 kids, she was not aggressive or a criminal. She had a hard time dealing with life, as many do, and tried to complete suicide 4 times. Twice she tried by slashing her wrists, and the other 2 times she attempted to OD on drugs. After her attempts, she tried to move on with her life, eventually saving her babysitting money to purchase a car. She met and knew Natasha and Joseph from school. Later, in 1998, she told a psychologist that she was still self-harming leading up to the event that took place in 1997. She also told the psychologist that spirits thrusted into her thoughts and caused her to strike out at herself. Karen said that she was an emotional mess and that nothing could make her happy, but she stated that she did not strike out at others. She explained to the doctor that she had severe mood swings, which included episodes of extreme depression, uncontrollable crying, and suicidal urges. She said she also experienced manic phases when she laughed uncontrollably. According to Karen, her mother had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and her behavior followed a similar pattern of depression and hyperactivity and rage. Karen's maternal grandmother and grandfather were also diagnosed with bipolar disorders. Karen said that she was hallucinating randomly, and she had participated in seances with Natasha. She went on to tell the psychologist that she was the medium in the seances and that spirits would come into her body, causing her to become sad and depressed. Despite her low IQ, it was determined that Karen had the ability to function within the average range of intelligence and had the capability to speak effectively, but she didn't function well under pressure and she gave up easily. This conclusion was determined by her low grades and her statement that she never paid attention in school. The psychologist concluded that Karen had a short attention span and possibly an attention deficit disorder. The doctor's report indicated that, quote, her judgment and reasoning abilities are quite poor. She thinks in a very simplistic, concrete fashion and cannot cope with or fully comprehend complexities in a social or interpersonal situation, end quote. The psychologist determined that she retreated into her eccentric spiritual world as a defense mechanism in order to cope with her various problems. The doctor's conclusions were that Karen suffered from bipolar disorder, depression with psychotic features, and post-traumatic stress disorder. On April 6, 1997, is when these six teenagers got together and made the plan to go to New Orleans, Louisiana. They used Joseph's car, but they didn't believe that his car would be able to make it the whole way to Louisiana, so they all convened and talked about how they may need to jack a car from a dealership or a random parking lot on the way. In the car were two guns, a 9mm and a 25 caliber pistol. When they pulled over to a rest area in Greene County, Tennessee, they ran into the Lillilid family, who had made a stop on the way home from a religious convention. Their children needed to use the restroom, and they all needed to stretch their legs a bit. The Lillilids bumping into these teenagers at this rest area would change everything, and the Lillilid family had no idea what they were about to go through. I'm going to take a commercial break and tell you about today's sponsor before we move on. Reverie True Crime is sponsored by BetterHelp. Without a healthy mind, being truly happy and at peace is extremely difficult. The good news is therapy does really work. The stigma around therapy needs to be broken. Life is hard and we all need someone to talk to that makes us feel comfortable. Therapy is literally whatever you want it to be. Maybe you're not feeling interested in anything right now and want some help to get you motivated about things that you haven't been feeling like doing in a while, so you need a push. Maybe you're feeling insecure in relationships or at work, not dealing well with stress. Whatever you need, it's time to stop being ashamed of normal struggles that all of us deal with. And honey, you need to start feeling better because you are worthy of happiness. With BetterHelp, you don't have to worry about finding an in-person therapist near you. BetterHelp is personalized online therapy that gives you options of video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. You can also turn your video off so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. BetterHelp is extremely reasonably priced, unlike in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. If you feel you're not vibing with the therapist that you get, You always have the option to change as many times as you'd like until you find the right therapist for you. Join the millions of people who are seeing what online therapy is really all about. It's always a good time to invest in and empower yourself because you matter, and it's important to me that you feel better. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Reverie True Crime listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/reverie. Put yourself first, take care of you, and go to BetterHelp.com/reverie to get 10% off your first month of therapy. Vidar Lillelid was born and raised in Norway. He moved to the U.S. in 1985. Vidar met Delfina Zelaya, who was Honduran-American and from New York City. They kept bumping into each other through their routine participation in the Jehovah's Witnesses church and activities. In 1989, the two wed, and in 1997, they had a 6-year-old daughter named Tabitha and a 2-year-old little boy, Peter. As the Lillelid family was making a pit stop at the rest area and the teenagers pulled in, Vidar was holding baby Peter and walked up to Natasha and Karen to talk to them about their views as Jehovah's Witnesses, as most of us have experienced before, also giving them a pamphlet. Joseph and Jason approached the four of them and started chit-chatting as well. All of a sudden, Joseph brandished one of the guns and said, quote, "I hate to do you this way, but we're gonna have to take you with us for your van," end quote. Joseph had the family at gunpoint as he instructed them to get into the van. Vidar was begging the crew of teenagers not to do this, even trying to give them the keys to the van, as well as his wallet, if he and his family could please just stay at the rest area. But Joseph was not having it. He made Vidar get in the driver's seat as he held him at gunpoint. Vidar was driving, Joseph was in the passenger seat, Jason, Karen, and Natasha were in the van with the rest of the Lillelid family, while Dean and Crystal were trailing right behind them in Joseph's car. The children were so upset, so Delfina started to sing to them, attempting to comfort her children, but Jason told her to stop. Then, Joseph ordered Vidar to hit the interstate until they saw a road that was pretty secluded by the next exit they came across. This little gravel road was Pain Hollow Lane, and that road is where something so sinister happened, it made the kidnapping and robbery seem trivial, like a cakewalk. The teenagers made the Lillelids line up near a ditch, where 3 of the 4 family members were fatally shot. Jason checked the bodies, presumably, and said, quote, "They're still fucking alive." This is when he proceeded to shoot them all again. Now, stories vary between each teenager at trial, which I am going to play some of the audio of what they said a little later. But the other 5 teenagers said they were talking about letting the family go when Jason started firing shots. Vidar was shot 5 times in his chest and once on the right side of his head. The autopsy concluded that the first shot was to the head and went through Vidar's right eye, through his temple, and went out of his right ear. The forensic pathologist couldn't be 100% certain, but he was pretty sure this only made Vidar go unconscious and the 9mm was the gun that was used. When Vidar would have collapsed to the ground, he was again shot 3 times in the upper right side of his chest. Later, it was mentioned that these shots were purposely done to form a certain shape, but we'll get to that in just a little bit. The .25 caliber pistol was also used, shooting Vidar under the nipple, Then the 9mm was used again and hit right below that gunshot wound. It's suspected that Vidar passed away a few minutes after the shooter shot him in the eye. There were apparent but light abrasions to the back of the legs that happened after Vidar had died. The shooter shot Delfina 8 times. All 8 bullets were also able to be retrieved from her body. 6 of the bullets were from the 9mm and 2 were from the 25 caliber pistol. The first shot of the 9mm broke and shattered a bone in her left arm. The second shot, from the same gun, completely fragmented her left thigh's femur. At this point, she would have been laying down on her back when she was shot 3 times in the left side of her abdomen. Again, it would come up that these 3 shots were intentionally to form a shape. The shots went through her stomach, through her pancreas, spleen, left kidney, and her left adrenal gland, which is right above the kidneys. The final shot of the 9mm was just above Delfina's belly button and was lodged into her spine. The 25 caliber pistol was shot at Delfina, hitting her under her left armpit, which lodged into the skin on the back of her left shoulder. Another bullet from the pistol was shot, wounding Delfina's left side, and that bullet was found in the middle of her liver. She too had abrasions on her leg. Soon we find out what actually caused these seemingly random abrasions on the family. Unfortunately, Delfina probably didn't pass away instantly. It was most likely that she suffered, and it was concluded that she could have laid there for up to 25 minutes, which also means she saw her whole family get gunned down, and she was possibly alive when the action that caused the abrasions were inflicted before she passed away. Now I'm going to talk about the Lilalid children. You can skip over this part if you need to, maybe hitting the skip button 4 or 5 times to see if you need to keep skipping or pull it back just a little. So unfortunately, the children were not excluded from this horrendous, crazy shooting that didn't even need to happen at all. Tabitha, only 6 at the time, was shot with the 25 caliber in the head. The bullet entered the left side of her head and went out behind her right ear. This immediately caused her brain to quit working. However, her organs were still going, and she was put on life support. But her uncle, who was her guardian, decided not to be selfish, which is a hard thing to do when it comes to adults on life support. So I cannot even fathom how difficult that must have been to make that decision about a 6-year-old little child. But he bravely did the day after that she was shot, since he knew that her brain would never function again, and the life support would basically only keep her body functioning. So Tabitha's uncle also donated her heart, liver, gallbladder, kidneys, pancreas, spleen, and adrenal glands. Even though her life was savagely taken, she would go on to save other lives through her death. There is a survivor in this story, Peter Lilalid, only 2 years old. Now, he was shot twice with the 25 caliber pistol. Once behind his right ear with the bullet coming out close to his right eye, and then shot again with the bullet piercing through his back and coming out of his chest. Peter Lilalid was taken to the University of Tennessee Memorial Hospital in Knoxville by helicopter straight to the pediatric intensive care unit. The 2-year-old got there in critical condition. There was extremely forceful resuscitation performed on him. He had a bruise on his right lung and persistent bleeding in his right chest cavity. This baby was such a fighter. 11 days later, doctors made the decision to remove Peter's eye that had been damaged beyond repair, and he stayed in the hospital for 17 days. Afterwards, 2-year-old Peter was taken to a recovery center that was also in Knoxville. It is shocking and amazing that this baby made it through this horrific tragedy. After the murders were committed, the 6 young teenagers hopped in the van, and when they left, the family was run over, which is what caused the abrasions on the bodies. They thought they left the whole family dead as they drove away to continue their journey to New Orleans. They left Joseph's car at the scene of the murders since it had gotten stuck where they couldn't drive it, but they took off the license plate, took the registration and everything they had out of the car, but they left the headlights on. There was a house not far away, and the resident of the home called 911 after hearing what they described as gunshots and children on a playground. The police were on their way to see what was going on and arrived around 8:20 that night. The first thing authorities saw was the car that had been left behind with its headlights still beaming. Then they saw the awful scene. After seeing that Delfina and Vidar were deceased, they realized the 2 children were still hanging on by a thread. They called for medical help, and then after the children were taken away to the hospital, the police got to work. It wasn't long before they discovered who was involved in the grisly murders of the Lillilid family. First, they were able to trace where the Lillilid family went that day, and eyewitnesses came forward that saw the car and the teenagers at the rest area talking to Vidar. The car was traced back to Joseph, and it was a pretty easy investigation process by the sound of things. As the 6 teenagers went through Georgia, they stopped at a Waffle House to eat. When they were leaving, a crew of police officers were there. It startled them enough that they ditched their plans to go to New Orleans altogether and decided they needed to get out of the country completely, attempting to flee to Mexico. They almost made it into Mexico on their first try, but when they got to the border, they didn't have the forms they needed to get in, so they found another way in illegally. Mexico wasn't as pleasant as they thought it would be. It definitely was not an escape. It's mentioned that Jason was shot in the hand and his leg. I'm not sure by who, but eventually they were stopped by the police, and they said that they were just lost. The Mexican police made the teenagers get out of the van, and they searched it over. They found a photo album that belonged to the Lillilid family, as well as a knife. They were all instructed to get out of Mexico and get back to the U.S. immediately. When the teenagers made it to the border, the American police were waiting. They also looked inside the van, and the teenagers were all handcuffed and hauled off to jail in Arizona. They got away with the murders of the Lillilid family for 2 days, but they were finally caught. A few of them even had various items that belonged to the Lillilid family on their person. When the sentencing hearing took place, Natasha said the first lawyer she had told her to claim that she was Satan's daughter. Berkeley Bell, the district attorney, had used the help of experts of occults throughout his investigation of the case, and he constantly brought up the angle of this being acts of an occult during interviews. However, during the hearing, he completely contradicted all of that, saying in his opinion the whole occult talk was a complete diversion and that he was glad Natasha wasn't being represented by that attorney any longer. Witnesses and prosecutors tried to throw around Satanism and involvement in the occult a lot during the trial, but there was never any proof to back any of this up. Since the DA, Berkeley Bell, would do interviews all of the time saying that the teenagers were inspired by the movie Natural Born Killers, the media ate this up. He went on to say that when the bodies of the Lilalids were found, they seemed purposefully arranged to look like a cross. He really dramatized this already tragic murder into something more than it was. There was nothing pointing to this being satanic, inspired by a movie, or any such thing. The sheriff, David Davenport, even said that when he was investigating the scene of the murders, the bodies were not organized in any kind of way, and he said he thinks the teenagers were just trying to get out of there as fast as they could. Natasha was constantly accused of worshiping Satan. She said yes, she believed Satan existed, but she also believed God did too. Natasha also said that she tried to contact spirits before, even demons, through various rituals. She said none of which were rituals of sacrificing humans or animals. All the speculation about satanic rituals and things of that nature really get under my skin, because people can be curious and experiment with things you don't believe in, and that's okay. Trying to make anyone feel like they've done something wrong because they perform seances or are into witchcraft or anything other than Christianity is always so screwed up to me. Especially manipulating others to believe things are evil and to make this case even worse than it already was. That's not cool either. Obviously, I don't agree with this crime, but it bugs me that so many trials during this time were over-sensationalized and it was never just about the crime that took place. Let's say it was satanic. It doesn't change that this family was murdered. The focus should be on a family that was gunned down, figuring out who was shooting the gun, and hard facts about the actual murder. I get that maybe they were trying to figure out a motive, but wasn't it obvious that they were just nonsensical teenagers who saw an opportunity to steal another vehicle, and they made nasty, horrific, and inexcusable decisions before taking that vehicle? It's just the satanic panic of it all for me, honestly. So I'm going to get off of my soapbox about that, but Natasha talked to a psychiatrist and went into further detail about things she was experiencing and had done in the past. So a psychiatrist interviewed Natasha on 3 occasions for a total of 8 hours. Natasha said that she had been hearing voices since the age of 2. Natasha claimed that antipsychotic medications did not help. The doctor stated that Natasha claimed to see some of the spirits or demons who spoke to her. She said that the spirits sometimes predicted her future, and at other times directed her to kill herself so that she could join them. The doctor reported that Natasha believed she was hassled in school for being a so-called freak. Natasha was smoking cigarettes by the age of 5 and claimed that she was regularly high on marijuana after she quit school. She also acknowledged prior use of crystal meth, PCP, and other illegal drugs. Natasha remarked that she had used LSD well over 100 times. The psychiatrist recalled that Natasha believed she had lived prior lives and had out-of-body experiences. She believed that her soul may have become pregnant at some point in her life. Natasha claimed to have been sexually abused at the age of 2, but said she couldn't recall the identity of the abuser. The psychiatrist reported that Natasha cut herself several times and on other occasions had overdosed on sleeping pills, lithium, and vodka. She was never hospitalized for an overdose. She also described periods of time where she would go without sleep. She said that while she was in New Orleans, that she slept in abandoned homes, and that she was gang raped and beaten by 5 men. During the rape, she reported that she, quote, tried not to be there. Natasha said that she could communicate with Karen Howell during her out-of-body experiences. She described Karen as her soulmate and stated that the two cut themselves the night before the Lillilid murders and they drank each other's blood. She also said that since the crimes, she and Karen have shared violent and disturbing dreams. The psychiatrist reported that Natasha cried when discussing the murders. She claimed to be especially upset because she was unable to save the children. She said that she would have left the group after the killings if she had known that her other friends would not have been hurt. The doctor concluded that Natasha was not psychotic nor out of touch with reality, but that she was, quote, clearly, mentally, and emotionally disturbed and has been for a number of years, end quote. The doctor said that she has symptoms of bipolar disorder and mixed personality disorder and had symptoms of dissociative disorder and antisocial traits. In the doctor's view, however, she was determined to be not legally insane when the crimes were committed. When it came to Joseph Risner's psychiatric evaluation, the doctor said the crimes did not fit with his previous life history. This doctor also indicated that her belief was that he would not pose any problems with his behavior while incarcerated. She concluded that Risner was extremely remorseful for the crime. The psychiatrist said that borderline personality disorder, typically associated with childhood trauma and/or neglect by primary caretakers, has the core characteristic of instability. According to the psychiatrist, borderline personality types resort to, quote, self-defeating and ineffective ways of coping, or they simply fall apart and decompensate under the weight of unmanageable emotions, end quote. Now I'm going to play for you Karen, Natasha, and Joseph talking on the stand about what they claim happened the evening of April the 6th, 1997.
You know, we want to go over and sit down at the picnic table and talk about it. And I was like, yeah, okay.
They were talking, Joe and Vidar, and about God or whatever. And I was talking to Delphina and Tabitha. And Tabitha, gave me and Karen a Hershey's kiss. Natasha, like, rises up and says, I think we should leave. And that's when Joe put down the gun, the 9mm. He says, I'm sorry I have to do this to you, but he said, everyone stay calm. We're just going to take a little ride. No one will get hurt. Walk slowly to the van.
Mr. Lulule got, like, He was visibly scared. The little boy didn't seem to be, he didn't even seem to know what was going on. Mrs. Lillibed was really shaken. I mean, she was tore up. She started, like, talking stuff. And the little girl was crying.
Delphina said, please don't hurt us. And that's when Jason took out the 25mm, caliber pistol, and points it at Tabitha and Delphina. Delphina started singing to calm Tabitha down, and Jason told her to shut up. She had taught Tabitha about guns, and that's why she was so scared. I told her it would be okay, that nobody would hurt her. And I promised I wouldn't leave anybody hurt her. Everybody to get out of the van. And Karen said, just let them get their stuff and go.
Mr. Leywood and Mrs. Leywood and the two children were standing in a ditch kind of in front of the car.
He was standing beside Delphina, and he didn't have Tabitha in his arms. Tabitha was standing directly in front of him. Okay. And he had his arm around her. Tabitha was crying again, and Jason said, make her shut up. And Vidar put his hand over her mouth. Vidar took out his wallet and said, take her money and take the vans, don't hurt us. Jason was asking Joe, what do you think we should do? Do you think we should let him go, or do you think we should kill him? And Joe said, I don't know, man, what do you think that we should do? And he said, I think we should kill him. I remember Natasha, like, trying to make Jason promise not to hurt the little kids. I started begging Jason not to do it, and he just wouldn't listen. And I knew somebody was going to die. So I walked over in front of the family, and I told him that I couldn't stop him from killing someone. So please don't let him hurt the kids. Will you please give me the kids so he won't hurt them? Vidar, like, tightens his grip on Tabitha. Like, he has one of his hands over her mouth because she was crying really bad. And he has an arm around Tabitha. And he tightened his grip on him when, after he said, if we let him go, they'll already be dead or something like that. Vidar said, if we die, the kids will be hurt anyways. And I turned around. I said, please stop this. Next thing I remember, I heard Jason shooting. I remember he had the 25 the first time. And I remember he shot the daughter first.
I heard another shot, and I saw Mrs. Lillett turn to her side, and she fell to the ground.
What did you do?
I jumped into the van, and I closed the door, and I started to cry.
I looked over at the car, and Crystal had her hands on her face, and Dean bowed down his head, and then I looked away.
I remember Jason yelling, saying they're still effing alive. He grabbed the 9 out of the floor, and he ran out, and I looked back, and Tabitha?
What was she doing?
She was standing over her mother.
What did Jason do?
I don't know. And he went right up to her. He went right up to her and shot her. He shot them all over again. When he came back, he was laughing. He said that Delphina was laying there speaking in tongues, and Vidar was jerking really bad.
I sat there for a minute and I tried to kind of get a grip. And I pulled the van forward and I pulled the van forward until I saw this house up there. And I think I said, SH, there's a effing house up there or something. And I started to turn the van around, like, really quickly. I mean, I was, like, ramming the sides of the ditch and stuff.
I was staring at the steering wheel. And I seen
Joe jerked it to the right, and we ran over something. And I turned around, and I looked in the back window, and we had ran over them. And Jason said, "That little girl looks like she just got effed. She's all sprawled out." And he was laughing about it.
Even with their testimonies, the district attorney was not going to be satisfied until each one of them were convicted. To make sure that this happened, he offered the six of them a deal. If they all pleaded guilty to murder in the first degree, none of them could be sentenced to death. All six of the teenagers signed the deal, and in March of 1998, they were convicted of felony murder and were to serve 3 life sentences. One for every family member who died, plus 25 years for the attempted murder of baby Peter Lillilid, with no possibility of parole. So, when it came to Natasha, this is what the trial court ruled as far as administering the maximum sentence possible for her. Quote, "Not only do the statutory aggravating circumstances outweigh those, but those mitigating circumstances are, in fact, rebutted by the facts of this case. A. History of some violent behavior. The fact that you had killing on your mind when you left Kentucky. Not necessarily a ringleader, but the evidence shows that you were the instigator and orchestrator of the trip, and the things that led to the death of the Lillilids. You took an active part in the kidnapping of the Lillilids at the rest area. You suggested that the guns be obtained." The following observations are about Jason Bryant, made by the trial court at the conclusion of the sentencing hearing. Quote, "I find that you were aggressively urging others on to do things at that time, and that you personally carried one of the guns. That, in fact, you were a shooter. I don't know who all were the shooters. I think there was more than one. I have seen no real remorse or emotion displayed by you. I find the evidence shows that you were aggressive in the killings, that you helped use a gun to kidnap the Lillilids in the first place. You had gunshot residue all over you. You were in the van for 2 days with Lillilid property all around you and under your feet, including a baby seat and baby's toys. You bragged about the crimes in jail in Arizona. You have a history of drug abuse and a callous attitude." The trial court ruled as follows when it came to Edward Dean Mullins. Quote, "You had positive gunshot residue on your sweater. You participated in all the events in Kentucky. You left the rest area with the Lillilids in Mr. Risner's automobile. You didn't have to do that. It was a deliberate and knowing act following the van. And there's really no proof of it, but the proof is that Delphina and Tabitha were crying at the picnic table before they got in the van, and it seems to me that conversations with them about that it's logical to assume beyond a reasonable doubt that you had to know something was wrong. You participated in the getaway and cover-up. You were in the van for 2 days with Lillilid property, a baby seat under your feet, and children's toys. You had many chances to get away, to do something about what was going on, to report that a child had been murdered and one baby left for dead. You did nothing. You were a participant in it by your actions and your non-actions. And I find, therefore, that the sentence should be, in each of the 3 counts of first-degree murder, life without the possibility of parole." The trial court ruled as follows when it came to Joseph Risner. Quote, "It was your car, driven by you, that made the trip. You held a gun on the Lillilids at the picnic table. You got the ball rolling in the kidnapping. You rode in the van with the little lids begging and crying and singing, and with a gun in your hand, and Peter in the baby seat. You deliberately ran over the little lids. You drove the getaway van. You were a leader. Not the leader, but a leader. You had the presence of mind to take the tag from your car, your papers, and clothes at the scene. The trial court found as follows when it came to Crystal Sturgis. Quote, there are some mitigating circumstances in your case, and perhaps more than for some other defendants. I find that you had no significant history of prior criminal activity. You were an accomplice in a murder committed by another person, and your participation was relatively minor. I agree with everybody that no participation in these events can be described as minor. The trial court, which observed that Crystal had a childhood marked by abuse and neglect, clinical depression, and borderline personality disorder, also ruled as follows. Quote, the mitigating circumstances are rebutted. There was a lot of talk in Kentucky about death and killing before you set out from Kentucky. You were present when everything was happening in Kentucky. The rituals, the stealing, getting the guns, preparing. You knowingly went in the car following the van from the rest area to that place. Tabitha and Delphina were crying even before they left the picnic table. Just like I told Mr. Mullins, you may not have pulled the trigger. You may have been horrified by this. But everything that you did showed that you adopted this and gave it your name. You were certainly a willing participant in the getaway and the cover-up. You had many chances to get away, many chances to report to authorities. You left a baby for dead at the scene of the crime. The district attorney retired, but even after that, he was still going with the narrative that this had to do with the family being religious and the teenagers not being religious. Quote, it was the highlight of my career as a prosecutor. The whole thing was driven by evil, almost a supernatural type of evil. That sense of evil just permeated the whole thing from start to finish. It infused the defendants and it empowered them. That's what I believed then, and my opinion has not changed. End quote. There are Facebook pages in favor of some of the now adult women getting granted clemency. A lot of people are on their side, saying they were scared teenagers witnessing a murder and didn't know what to do. Others are completely opposed to any of the six receiving any kind of flexibility of their sentences and should be locked up for life. In 2020, Karen Howell was preparing to file for clemency, so we'll have to see what happens with that. Now, she was denied a similar request in 2017. Lastly, I wanted to leave on a positive note. Peter Lillilid, the sole survivor, then little baby fighting for his life, was put in the custody of his aunt and uncle who lived in Sweden, and this was decided on by a chancellor. Chancellor Fred McDonald said that Peter should be raised by his aunt Randy, who was a daycare provider, and her husband Ode, a commuter airplane pilot, and they lived in Stockholm. The chancellor picked Vidar's family over Delphina's American relatives because they had a stable family life and they were in the Jehovah's Witness religion, which would give Peter a life that was more akin to what his parents probably wanted for him. Also, Peter was to be treated at the Nobel Prize-affiliated Karolinsk Institute, where actor Christopher Reeve also received treatment. Christopher Reeve was the one who wrote to the court to recommend that Peter be treated there. Randy and Ode had not met Peter before the slayings, but they were more than happy to take him in. And that again was from the AP News in 1997. On the third anniversary of the shootings, A Greenville Sun reporter called Randy, and she told the reporter that the family is now trying to keep a low profile and protect Peter from any media. She said, quote, "We don't want to say anything about it anymore. He needs to go on with his life, and we want him to grow up as a normal child." Randy did say that she had told Peter about what happened to his family in the U.S. Quote, "He knows everything about what happened, but it's not fun for him to read about in the media." Randy would not answer any other questions about Peter. In 2007, Peter was around 12 years old and still had trouble walking, but reportedly he was living a happy life. "I tried to find more on Peter, but I personally couldn't find anything about him now. So I hope he is doing well, and my condolences go out to everyone who knew the Lillilid family." Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Before I go, I want to thank my lovely Patreon members at patreon.com/reverietruecrime. Also, if you sign up in November, December, and January are free. I'm pausing payments for those 2 months. Thanks so much for the extra support and love, Brandy, Anthony, Erica, Dooley, Corey, Justin, Angel, TZ, Tyler, Kimberly, Jade, Marianne, Jamie, Sapper, Iris, Jimmy, Shannon, Matt, Chelsea, Jigglypuff, Kara, Melissa, and Lorraine. Until next time, everyone, stay safe and take care.